Our speaker this afternoon has for many years been deeply involved in the life and witness of the Iona community. One time warden of Iona Abbey, currently leader of the Iona community, of which I am a member. She is a campaigner in areas of poverty, justice, and peace, a writer who brings to those concerns a spirituality of lively engagement. And she's also a good singer with a keen interest in music. And at Greenbelt this weekend, she will be sharing with us her thoughts on what happens when social concerns and music join together. So we look forward to hearing what she has to say this afternoon, and would you join with me now, please, in giving a warm Greenbelt welcome on her return to the festival to Cathy Galloway.
Don't you mourn, oh Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh Mary, don't you weep. If I could, I surely would stand on the rock where Moses stood. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Some of you might recognize that song. It's on a new album by Bruce Springsteen called We Shall Overcome, the Seeger Sessions, which recorded songs that had originally been popularized by the American folk singer Pete Seeger. The album was given as a gift to me a couple of months ago, and the first time I played it, I realized with a shock that I knew all the words of almost all the songs on it. What was even more disconcerting was the fact that I had learned them well over 30 years ago. And apart from one, I hadn't sung them since that time. That gift came after a conversation I had with Martin Rowe about songs that stay with people for a long time and that still have the power to startle and move us when we come upon them unexpectedly. I went to two concerts in Glasgow in the spring. The first was a Richard Thompson concert, and the second was a Joan Baez concert. And I was laughing at the fact that the majority of people in the audience for both of them were well past the first flush of youth. I watched the audience come in and take their seats. Here we were, because I have to include myself among this group, the baby boomer generation grown middle-aged, with grey hair or no hair, thickening waistlines, sensible shoes and handbags and credit cards. And I thought, is this what we have become? With a mixture of amusement and horror. We all looked so respectable. We all looked rather dull. But then the house lights went down and the stage lights went up, and a strange thing happened. It was as if, in the dark, we underwent some kind of metamorphosis. As the performers came on stage, there was a kind of collective rumble or roar. People began to clap and whistle and stamp, and they joined in songs and shouted out and started dancing. None of this is very unusual at concerts, of course, But the effect was of what looked like a very staid audience indeed, loosening its collective corsets. You could almost feel all these 40 and 50-somethings rolling back the years. You could smell the grass as the Glasgow Concert Hall sung along to Richard Thompson singing Crazy Man Michael. But for me, the most curious moment came when a couple of thousand people joined in John Baez's singing of Amazing Grace and knew every single one of the words. How did they know all the words? Not, I would speculate, because they all went to church every Sunday. Well, it's one of these songs that defines a generation, a moment, a struggle. It's an iconic song. Perhaps you could call it a redemption song. But the whole thing made me think hard about the way particular songs capture the imagination and about the songs that have accompanied and shaped my own particular journey as a peace and justice activist. And that's what I'm going to talk about this afternoon. And I'm going to sing about them too. And please join in any songs that you know. The rain is now coming down fairly heavily, so I'd like to give the people who are sitting here on the grass the opportunity at this point to move over and get undercover somewhere. I'll just sing while you do that, so do join in. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. I'm really impressed with you tough folks sitting here on the grass. I've had a lot of different roles in my life, but I am first and foremost and probably always an activist and campaigner. I began campaigning at the age of about 13, trying to persuade classmates at school to put up anti-apartheid posters and refrain from eating South African oranges. And I went on my first march when I was 15. Since then, I have signed countless petitions, lobbied countless politicians, been on countless marches and demonstrations, the last one only 2 weeks ago today. As a young mother in the 1980s, I started the Edinburgh Peace and Justice Centre, joined Parents for Survival, and traipsed around the country, often with a baby in tow, speaking about Cruise and Trident. I have embraced the base at Greenham Common and blockaded the base at Faz Lane. I have been arrested and now have a criminal record. I have visited US military bases in Okinawa, refugee camps in Gaza and the West Bank, the Israeli Foreign Ministry, Moscow in the last days of the Soviet Union. I have met women in divided villages in Bosnia, street children in Zimbabwe, paramilitaries from Northern Ireland, members of the National Rifle Association in Missouri. I have worked with people in poor communities in the west of Scotland, organized poverty hearings with politicians, run writing groups for survivors of the mental health system. I've worked for the campaign for a Scottish Parliament, for Church Action on Poverty. I've spoken on hundreds of platforms, written hundreds of articles, and travelled thousands of miles. Occasionally, I try to give up being an activist. I try to put my head down and do my garden, but it never works for very long. I first heard the song, Mary, Don't You Weep, as a child on Iona in the early 1960s. It's an African-American spiritual, and it became an important anthem for the civil rights movement in America during that decade. It was often sung at Cayley's and in worship on Iona, along with other songs from the struggle to end the political, economic, and social apartheid that existed in the southern states of the U.S. Then it was called segregation. But it was the same thing, a brutal and discriminatory system sanctioned by the state and held in place by racist attitudes. Slavery might have ended after the Civil War, but its legacy lived on. One of the important and interesting things about the civil rights movement is how deeply rooted it was in Christianity, primarily that of African Americans, but also of the white Americans who acted in solidarity in marches and sit-ins and freedom rides. Many of its leaders were clergy, of whom Martin Luther King Jr. was only the best known. The religious aspect of the movement was clearly evident in its songs, most of which were spirituals that came from the time of slavery and took as their defining narrative and model the Exodus, the deliverance of the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt. And so that verse that I sang says, "If I could, I surely would stand on the rock where Moses stood." And it refers to the part in the book of Exodus where the Israelites were wandering in the wilderness with nothing to drink, no clean water. They began to complain to Moses, saying to him, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt just to die of thirst?" The Bible says that Moses prayed earnestly to the Lord, and the Lord told him to strike a rock at Mount Sinai with his stick. So Moses did that, and the sweet water gushed out. The Bible also says the place was named Massah, which means testing, and Meribah, which means complaining, because it was here that the Israelites complained and tested the Lord by asking, "Is the Lord with us or not?" The water from the rock didn't only save their lives, it became a sign that the Lord wanted people to be free. And that's what people in the civil rights movement believed, that segregation was not God's will, no matter who said so, no matter even if churches said so. And therefore, to do nothing in that circumstance was to collude with evil and oppression. So people would organize and march and boycott and resist the evil of racism. African Americans have a long history of suffering, and the spirituals that had enabled them to keep on keeping on, as Martin Luther King described it, accompanied them once more on the long march to freedom. Another interesting thing about the civil rights movement, another important thing, is that it was a non-violent movement. It was a liberation struggle, but it wasn't a war. These words of Martin Luther King's about non-violence are famous. "I would like to say to you this morning what I've tried to say all over this nation, what I believe firmly, that in seeking to make the dream a reality, we must use and adopt a proper method. I'm more than ever before convinced that nonviolence is the way. I'm more convinced than ever before that violence is impractical as well as immoral. If we are to build right here a better America, we have a method as old as the insights of Jesus of Nazareth and as modern as the techniques of Mohandas K. Gandhi. We need not hate. We need not use violence. We can stand up before our most violent opponent and say, we will match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering." "We will meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we will still love you. We cannot, in all conscience, obey your unjust laws, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. And so throw us in jail. We will go in these jails and transform them from dungeons of shame to havens of freedom and human dignity. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our communities after midnight hours, and drag us out on some wayside road, and beat us, and leave us half dead. And difficult as it is, we will still love you. Somehow go around the country and use your propaganda agents to make it appear that we are not fit culturally, morally, or otherwise for integration, and we will still love you. Threaten our children and bomb our homes, and difficult as it is, we will still love you. But be assured that we will ride you down by our capacity to suffer. One day we will win our freedom, but we will not only win freedom for ourselves. Thank you. Yeah, that's better. Thank you. Okay, thank you. One day we will win our freedom, but we will not only win freedom for ourselves. We will so appeal to your heart and your conscience that we will win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. The story of the civil rights movement in America is an inspiring one. It achieved desegregation, civil rights, equality under the law. It also paid a high price in suffering. Its songs are converting songs. These songs converted me. They changed my life more than any rally, altar call, or Bible study ever did. Songs like this one. Oh, freedom, oh, freedom, oh, freedom over me, and before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave, and go home to my Lord and be free. No more segregation, no more segregation, no more segregation over me, over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. They'll be singing, they'll be singing, they'll be singing over me, over me, and before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. I am not black. I am not an American. I did not suffer racism or segregation. But at the age of 13, I knew that this vision of Christianity and this Jesus, articulated and embodied in the moral passion and costly commitment of the civil rights movement, and also of people I knew personally as well, was something worth giving my life to. I have never changed my mind about that. I learned these songs on Iona. Would it be easier if I just held this? Okay. Excuse me a minute. I learned these songs on Iona in the Inner Hebrides of Scotland from people who shared that same commitment and that same conviction. Some of them were Americans who came and shared their stories with members of the Iona community. Others were community members who had been working in Africa and who had taken part in liberation movements of countries in Africa struggling to free themselves from European colonialism. They too brought back songs to Scotland, learned in the heat of economic, political, and racial oppression somewhere else. It was from that time, in the 1950s and the 1960s, that the explosion of words and music of the World Church into the Iona community began. Jesus came and laid down his life for us. The poor are served and the hungry fed. O Lord, Jesus came to each needy child of God. The poor are served and the hungry fed. O God. By the 1960s, Martin Luther King had begun to speak out against the Vietnam War, encountering in the process even more hostility. The opposition to this long, morally compromised involvement, which brutalized so many, corrupted so many, and failed to achieve any American objectives while staining its international reputation, this movement became global. And its songs became global as well. This movement, too, was largely non-violent. Many Christians were part of it. And the biblical imagery was once again evident in the songs. I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside, down by the riverside. Down by the riverside, I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield. Down by the riverside, I ain't gonna study war no more. 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 Demonstrations and marches took place across the world, and young people in particular mobilized as part of a youth and student movement that challenged what they saw as a materialist, violent, and corrupt social order. In England, 100,000 people protested against the Vietnam War. In France, student protests against police brutality in May 1968 were joined by a strike of 10 million workers and brought down the government. Later that year, a period of political liberalization in Czechoslovakia that was known as the Prague Spring was brutally put down when Soviet tanks occupied the country. The pattern of peaceful demonstration being met with state brutality came to a head in 1970 when four students were shot dead by the Ohio National Guard at Kent State University in the United States. The shootings were the culmination of 4 days of increasingly agitated demonstrations by members of the student body. They were protesting the American invasion of Cambodia, which Richard Nixon launched in April 1970. There were significant national consequences to the shootings. Hundreds of universities, colleges, high schools, and even elementary schools closed throughout the United States due to a student strike of 8 million students. And the event further divided the country among political lines. The anti-war movement was swelled by millions of Americans who were calling into question a government that killed its own young in defense of its foreign policy. Eventually, the combination of military failure against a guerrilla army and hostile public opinion forced the United States to withdraw defeated from the devastated countries of Southeast Asia. This is Southeast Asia we are talking about. Bob Dylan's questioning anthem seemed appropriate to a somber mood. How many roads must a man walk down before you can call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? How many times must the cannonball fly before they are forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? How many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? How many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. By the 1970s, I had been on my first demonstration against the Vietnam War and was well on my way to becoming a fully fledged activist. By now, the focus of much of my activism had become the women's movement. I am one of these people nowadays who almost dare not speak their name. I am a feminist, by which I mean someone, thank you, by which I mean someone who believes in the equal status and value of women, advocates for equal rights and responsibilities for women, and seeks measures that redress imbalances of well-being, health, and education for women. Why was I a feminist in 1970? Let me put it this way. When I was a teenager, and that's not so very long ago, it was legal to pay women less than men for doing exactly the same job. It was legal to discriminate against women in employment, vocational training, education, and the provision of goods and services. it was legal to exclude women from a wide range of premises and activities because they were women. It was legal for a woman to be forced to resign from her job if she got married. It was legal for a woman to have to obtain her husband's written consent to open a bank account or take out a mortgage. It was legal for a man to rape his wife. It was illegal for a woman to have an abortion for any reason whatsoever. All of these things have changed, in Britain at least, and I am proud to have been part of the movement that brought about these changes. People often tell me that there is no need for feminism now, and feminists like me are still accused of being strident, of wanting to stop people having fun, and of wanting to stop women wearing lipstick. Give me a break. So why am I still a feminist? In the USA, every 15 seconds a woman is beaten. Every 6 minutes a woman is raped. Every day, 4 women are killed by abusive men. In parts of Africa, tens of thousands of girls are routinely subjected to female genital mutilation. In New Guinea, 67% of women are victims of domestic violence. In parts of India, women are still burned alive. In other places, they are the regular victims of so-called honor killings and rapes. In Britain, an act of domestic violence against a woman is committed every 6 seconds, and an attack is reported every minute. It is estimated that at least 1 in 3 children suffer some form of sexual abuse, usually at the hands of a known man. This is a global pandemic, a holocaust against women. Recognized as a major health hazard to them by the British Medical Association, but found in every country in the world, violence against women takes many forms. Domestic violence, incest and child abuse, sexual harassment, rape, unrealistic and degrading representations of women in the media, trafficking in women, institutional gender violence, the use of rape as a weapon of war, and this is by no means an exhaustive list. But there are other forms of violence of which women are disproportionately victims. 70% of the world's 1,200 million poor are women. 66% of the world's illiterate people are women. 80% of the world's refugees and uprooted peoples are women. The majority of people now testing HIV positive are women. Women from ethnic minorities, indigenous women, refugees, asylum seekers, travellers, have less access to resources and less resources to access, are more likely to be victimised, stereotyped, patronised, are less likely to be asked what their needs are or even to be communicated with in their own language. And some women who experience violence may be caught between community pressure to stay silent and racism when they break the silence. And all of this does not include the women who suffer direct violence, injury and death in war, completely disproportionately, as we have seen only this month in Lebanon. That is why I am still a feminist. And because I am a religious feminist, I have also learned to make a critique of the moral inferiority and practical inequality that much Christian theology and practice has imposed in women, and of the aspects of it which have legitimized violence against women. By the early 1980s, I had become a member of the Iona community, attracted by its rule of prayer and action for justice and peace, and particularly by its commitment to nonviolence. I became increasingly involved in the peace movement's campaign against the global arms trade and against nuclear weapons, and this campaign is a core commitment of the Iona community. In 1981, 36 Welsh women, including a member of the Iona community, set out from Cardiff to walk to the American air base at Greenham Common, 120 miles away. The group was called Women for Life on Earth, and they were protesting against the announcement that NATO cruise missiles were to be stored at the base. They captured the interest of the media by chaining themselves to the perimeter fence, demanding an open debate with the government on nuclear armaments. This group became the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp, where hundreds of women lived and tens of thousands of other women came to join in non-violent demonstrations. They set up 9 camps at the different gates, each one known by a colour of the rainbow and with a particular theme, so that Violet Gate was the camp for religious women, Red Gate was the artist camp, and so on. The women would stage actions or acts of protest, which ranged from lying down in front of lorries and threading paper peace doves and baby clothes into the perimeter fence, to cutting through the fence with bolt croppers, exercising what they stated was their right to walk on common land. The law lords later found that they were right. The site was on common land, and they could not be stopped from walking on it, although damaging the fence in order to get into it was still a criminal offence. Confrontations between sometimes hundreds of women, local authorities, police and the military were often heated and heavy-handed. Newbury District Council tried on an almost daily basis to evict women from the site. It arranged for bailiffs with a dedicated dust cart to tour the peace camp and destroy tents and possessions. After the first eviction, rocks were dumped across the site of Yellow Gate Camp by council workers, saying it was scheduled for landscaping. Many women were arrested and imprisoned. In 1982, 30,000 women arrived at Greenham to embrace the base. The following day, the Daily Mirror carried a single word as its front page headline. That word was peace. The Greenham women had become a huge media issue. Another blockade had 50,000 women, another 70,000. In 1987, America and Russia signed the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty that began a reduction in nuclear weapons. Cruise missiles began to leave Greenham, and by 1992, the American Air Force and all its weapons had gone. Of course, there were many factors in this, but the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp made an impact in a number of regards. It provided a model for non-violent direct action, still used by justice, peace, and environmental activists across the world. It fostered an environment where women learned that they didn't need to speak or act on men's terms, that they could act independently in the service of life on earth. And women across the world, in India, in Kenya, in Southeast Asia, are acting and speaking independently in the service of life on earth now. The peace camp didn't damage the environment or leave anything behind it. Women lived there for years, but very shortly after they left, there was no sign that they had been there. Above all, it was hugely influential in making people as a whole more aware of the issues surrounding nuclear weapons and in creating the climate for nuclear reduction treaties in the 1980s. At a time when nuclear proliferation and nuclear reduction treaties are under serious and sustained threat, and when our government is planning to upgrade Britain's Trident nuclear capability, regardless of the views of the British public, which are consistently opposed to this, it seems a good time to remember Greenham. It seems a good time to remember as we plan to upgrade our nuclear weapons that we are one of the countries telling Iran that they are not allowed to even enrich uranium. The most famous of the Greenham songs was an affirmation of the spirit, but also reflecting the times. It was the first time, I think, that female imagery made its way really into the spiritual canon, because it's amazing how many people still think that God is a man. You can kill the spirit, she is like a mountain, old and strong, she goes on and on and on. You can kill the spirit, she is like a mountain, old and strong, she goes on and on and on. You can The peace movement was not the only place where going on in the face of apparently insuperable obstacles was important. On another continent, in South Africa, the liberation struggle against apartheid was at its most critical stage. By this time I was living in Iona, and at Easter 1985, we learned a collection of songs entitled collectively, Freedom is Coming. These songs came to us like water struck from the rock, bringing both inspiration and challenge. They had been collected by Anders Nyberg, a Swede, and they came directly from the lived experience of suffering and hope of people for whom song was often the only form of resistance left open. These were the last years of apartheid rule, a white supremacist and racist system that denied the majority black population its democratic rights, classified people according to skin color, criminalized interracial marriage, and the country, which was by now effectively a white police state, was more or less in a constant state of emergency. Massacres as a response to non-violent civil protest were routine. Draconian laws that forbade people to meet in groups of more than three and brutal police repression meant that worship and funerals, of which there were a great many of people who died by violence, were often the only ways that people could express their legitimate aspirations, their suffering and their hope. Once again, the songs of faith from this 90% Christian country became the articulation of a costly faith. Across the world, people joined in the anti-apartheid movement. In Britain, in spite of the fact that the Conservative government of Margaret Thatcher colluded with and gave great comfort to the apartheid regime, hundreds of thousands of people marched, wrote letters, boycotted South African goods in economic sanctions that played an important part in ending apartheid. The Iona community had been deeply involved in this movement. Some of our members had been banned in South Africa. Others had been deported or exiled. And so we sang these songs. We sang them on Iona in solidarity with those who endured what we only heard about. We sang them on marches. We sang them outside the South African consulate in Glasgow, who had to suffer the ignominy not only of us having these songs sung outside their office, but Glasgow City Council changing the name of the square from Royal Exchange Square to Nelson Mandela Square. We sang these songs as part of a global movement for justice, knowing that the greatest burden was being borne by those facing bullets and whips in the townships of South Africa. We sang them, and what we discovered was that whatever political impact they might have in changing South Africa, the greatest impact was on us. These songs were changing us. These were also converting songs. They confronted us with a Jesus who refused the military option and chose instead the way of loving non-violence and self-offering, who stood beside those who were oppressed and excluded, a Jesus who loved justice and gave hope, a Jesus who said that the day of the Lord was not 1,000 years in the future, not in some pie in the sky when you die, a theological premise whose jacket is on a very shaky nail, and which mostly serves the interests of those who much prefer it if the poor and wretched of the earth can be persuaded to postpone salvation until they're dead. The day of the Lord is now here today. A Jesus who turned away from racism and lived welcoming to all. A Jesus who was angry with those who fleeced the poor, especially when they did it in the name of religion. But a Jesus who also said, we must love our enemies and overcome evil with good. They confronted us with a Jesus who said, there is another way. Choose which way you will follow. A Jesus who said, freedom is coming. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom, oh, freedom, freedom is coming. Oh, yes, I know. Oh, yes, I know. Oh, yes, I know. Oh, yes, I know. Freedom is coming. Oh, yes, I know. Oh, Jesus, oh, Jesus, oh, Jesus, Jesus is coming. Oh, yes, I know. Oh, yes, I know. Oh, yes, I know. Oh, yes, I know. Freedom is coming. Oh, yes, I know. That wasn't the end of my life as an activist. It's had other chapters, but I'm not going to inflict them on you today. And you might well think that I sound like a bit of a butterfly, flitting from cause to cause, and that I really need to loosen up and have some fun. Although, actually, I think I've had more than my fair share of that in the whole process as well. But the truth is that I think that justice is indivisible and liberation is indivisible. And Jesus didn't draw boundaries that said, only care about these people over here and not the ones over there. So I guess I will just go on being an activist until I die. But this is not really about me at all. It's about being a part of whole movements of people who believed that they could make a difference and who did make a difference and who had great songs to sing. I'm not sure what the redemption songs are in 2006. I heard it said about this year's title, Redemption Songs, that what it definitely wasn't about was folk singers singing cheesy protest songs. So that's one of the reasons that I got up here to sing cheesy protest songs. I'm not saying that there aren't any redemption songs in 2006, just that it's hard to hear them over the hysteria and the iPods. If you have any suggestions of what they might be, I'd love to hear them. And I invite you to come tomorrow. I'm going to speak again tomorrow, and particularly about the contemporary challenges, the contemporary war challenges, and the contemporary economic challenges. But in the meantime, I want to finish by singing the one song from the Seeger Sessions that I've sung continuously over 30 years in Russia and in America, in North and South, in Africa and Asia and Europe and South America. And this is a song that I found people everywhere know and sing and want to sing, however cheesy it is, everywhere that the struggle for justice and peace and equality and freedom goes on. So please, you must know this one. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday. We shall live in peace. We shall live in peace. We shall live in peace someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday. Thank you.